It's cool story, cool story. The Wheel of Time, the ultimate fantasy. It's cool story, cool story.
Wow. I think that was the most in sync we've ever been.
I have to agree with you.
Thank you.
It was also the most Backstreet Boys we have ever been.
I was going to say a NSYNC reference that I saw on Facebook the other day was somebody posted something that was like, blah, blah, blah. Oh, it's April. And in 2 weeks, and then literally it was just a picture of Top Ramen.
That's much better. I was going to yell at you.
It's going to be me.
I'm over that meme every year, so I was going to yell at you.
But the Top Ramen was pretty great. That really gave me a good laugh.
Even back in the day when he was sporting that look and it was supposed to be, you know, appealing, I was not secretly attracted to him in sync.
JC Chazé, on the other hand.
100%. JC
Chazé. And he's a better singer.
A better singer, but a less interesting person.
Do you think so? I've never, I never really followed him. But I was always confused how he didn't have more of a career, since I thought he was a better singer and cuter.
That's often how it happens, though.
Yeah.
Just saying. I mean, Brian was not the best singer in Backstreet Boys, nor was Nick.
I don't like the Backstreet Boys very much. I only like Everybody.
See, I was more Backstreet Boys than I was in NSYNC.
Oh, hard to disagree.
I would change it now, looking back retrospectively at their catalogs. Yeah, I would change it now. But at the time, you know what it was? Because Britney was with Backstreet Boys. Like, they were the paired together.
But she was dating Justin.
And isn't that funny?
Isn't that funny?
I was on the right side. I'm not a big, Justin. Yeah.
Well, I have a couple of corrections from Pythos, but I also have a couple of random things that I wanted to mention. Which would you rather do first?
Ooh, let's do the random things, because I have one of those, too.
Okay, number one is, there's somebody that I follow on Twitter who follows us back, who is reading The Wheel of Time, and they just got to the last book. And I was, realizing there are going to be moments in this series where I just want to watch you read the book. And I'm like, maybe I can convince Matt to just record himself reading
easy.
The book.
Easy. I could do that anyway, because you know me, I love to be dramatic.
I do know that about you.
I would do that in a second, a heartbeat.
Well, great. That was it. And the other thing is just a little recommendation for anybody out there who's on Twitter and on Wheel of Time Twitter. If you aren't following the account Bad Watt Takes, BADWOT Takes, you're only getting half the story. Because they're so, so, so funny. So I just wanted to say that people should be following them.
Shout out. I can't wait for the moment when I can start really enjoying Wheel of Time memes.
Oh my God.
You're
probably going to be able to get into the TV show memes and all of that.
Yeah, yeah. I have one thing I wanted to bring up. Remember when you asked me in book one and then again in book two, I think, who the hottest guy in the world was to cast?
In the world, yes.
Okay.
And I said independent of age, because my choice was Daniel Dae Kim, who is far too old at this point to be playing Galad, but I would still pick him.
I still stand behind my original good choices and all, but...
Are you going to pick Milo Ventimiglia?
I am. You only know it's Milo, I think, but you only know this because you see on the list, right? Or did you just know?
No, I just saw it on the list.
Okay.
Milo, which Milo is it?
I don't know why I didn't think of this. I just think he is one of the most beautiful men. I cannot even handle it. Ever since...
Did you see the picture of him on the internet lately of him leaving the gym in the really shorty short
shorts?
That
is exactly what reminded me. That is exactly what reminded me. I am watching This Is Us currently as well, but that is exactly what reminded me. I was like, oh my God, how did I forget?
I think he's attractive. I wouldn't say he's the most attractive man in the world.
The way he talks out of the side of his mouth, I just can't even handle it. He just does something to me.
I definitely think he was the most attractive boyfriend of Rory's on Gilmore Girls.
Oh, yeah, I agree.
Although Dean was pretty hot when he came back from college.
That's all I got for that.
I wanted to bring up something you, and I think one or two episodes ago, you recommended Solar Opposites.
Oh, that's so, I recommended it in our other podcast.
Okay, I haven't watched it yet, but I didn't realize that it's by the Rick and Morty creators.
Oh, I didn't, you know what? Now that you said that, that doesn't surprise me based on the animation, but I had no idea.
I still need to go watch it, but I just thought it was so funny that it's Rick and Morty creators, which I am always fucking talking about.
Yeah, and I would double down on that recommendation. I'll carry it over to this podcast. We watched a few more episodes of it since then. I think it's really funny.
I also want to just recommend, I have a music recommendation, which is, have you heard Lana Del Rey's new album?
What is the most current one?
Chemtrails Over the Country Club.
No, the last album I heard was the one with the Summertime remix on it.
That was like five albums ago.
That was Norman fucking Rockwell, and it was one album ago.
Okay. I didn't think that was on there. Summertime Sadness, I'm not going to lie.
Oh, no, not Summertime Sadness. Summertime, the cover of Summertime by Sublime.
Got it. Sorry. Okay. Doin' Time, not
Summertime. Oh, yes. Wow. Yeah, hello.
Wow. Because Summertime Sadness was one of her hits from like album number two.
Yeah, probably.
Which, controversial opinion, I don't like that song.
I loved it at the time. When I hear it now, I don't like it as much.
I think of it every week, though, on Sunday, because I think about how I've got that Sunday night sadness, because the next day is Monday.
Oh my god.
Anyway, it's a really, I think her new album is really, really good. I've been listening to it a lot, and so just wanted to recommend it.
I like her. I'm a big fan of hers, actually.
I love her music. It turns out she seems to be kind of a trash person, but I'm liking her music. Yeah, she's posting really stupid things lately.
I've read a few things that she posted like a couple months ago about, I don't know, I just want to listen to her. I just want to like, you know what I want? I just want to like music. You know what I mean? I just want to fucking like music.
Yeah.
There's this poem. It's called I just wanted eggs or something like that. But it's basically like she's talking about how she wants eggs, but she can't have them because she found out that, you know, they're not cage free and they're not cruelty free. So she has to get something else. And then she's thinking about the cup of coffee she's going to get. But she can't do that because she's thinking about the unfair wages for
labor practices.
All this kind of stuff. And she kind of goes over this whole thing and she's like, I just wanted eggs. And I'm like, that is exactly how I feel sometimes. Damn it.
Well, see, that's the thing, is what I try to remind myself and others is that there is no ethical consumption under capitalism, and so we can't make perfect choices, we can only make better choices.
Beautiful.
So, we do have a few corrections from Pythos, so let me just share those, and then we can get into the episode.
Okay.
So, item number one, a couple episodes ago, we talked about Semi-Charmed Life and how that was about meth. Was that about meth?
I only know for sure that it's, like, a bunch of, like, spoiled white teenagers doing recreational drugs. I think it's, like, meth or coke or something.
So Pythos says, there's a line from the song. The lyrics say, doing crystal meth will lift you up until you break.
Yeah.
But it was edited out of the radio version. So that makes sense that I never knew it, because it's not a song that I would have, like, gone and bought the album. So I never would have heard that version.
I know that line because I've done it too many times at karaoke.
I thought you were good. I thought you were like, I've done crystal meth too many times, so I really know that line.
No.
Oh, yeah. Eric Clapton did, in fact, have a top 40 Billboard hit with a song called Cocaine in 1997, but it was a cover by an artist named J.J. Cale, who I do not know.
Okay.
And remember how we talked about misheard lyrics and I talked about the cross-eyed bear?
Mm-hmm.
So it turns out that is an actual phenomena called mondegreens, and it's because a writer in the 1950s described mishearing a lyric from a Scottish ballad. The lyric was, laid him on the green, but he heard it as Lady Mondegreen. And so it's what it's called. It's mondegreen. And the most famous one is probably Jimi Hendrix, Excuse Me While I Kiss the Sky, is so often misheard as, excuse me while I kiss this guy. Yeah. Okay, and lastly, we talked about how hard Nintendo games are, and Pythos points out that, I think we kind of hinted at this, but that so many of them were ports from the arcade era where it was intended to be really difficult so kids would keep pumping in quarters.
Yeah.
So that just kind of translated over, and it's called, there's like a phenomena called Nintendo hard, because it like is about how hard the game is relative to the arcades.
I like that. It's like the hard setting when you start the game.
There's a, so I've been playing that game from my childhood, Master of Magic. Mm-hmm. Still, I'm still playing it. I really need to stop playing it and play something else. But there's difficulty settings, and it's like easy, and then normal, and then fair, and then it has hard, expert, and then the highest one is lunatic. And I thought that I was good at this game, but I think once I have beaten fair, which is like level 3 out of 6. All right, that's all I've got.
This isn't really a recommendation. Maybe it's a recommendation. You know what movie we watched the other day?
Ooh, what?
Drop Dead Gorgeous.
Oh my god, I haven't seen that in so long.
It's been a good long time for me too. It was one of the Jar movies, and Davey has never seen it, so I was really excited. I will say, it's still really funny. Some parts don't age as well as others.
I figured.
But I mean, you have to consider the type of movie it is, too. It's like very much a dark comedy making fun of all the characters. They're not supposed to be people that you're aspiring to enjoy.
isn't it kind of like produced by the same sort of folks as Best in Show?
Yeah, I don't know if it's this. I think it's the same people, actually, if not.
Oh, okay.
You know, the same type of feel, you know?
Denise Richards dressed as Mount Rushmore is possibly the best thing that's ever happened.
Oh my god, it was so good. So that was a good throwback for me that we really enjoyed.
Oh, I have a question for you.
Yeah.
What are your thoughts on Kirsten Dunst? Do you love her? Do you hate her? What are your thoughts on her acting?
I've grown to really like her a lot. Growing up, I thought she was a poor actress.
Uh-huh.
And then I've just seen her in enough different type of roles where I really like her. I think she knows her lanes. She has a few of them, and she does them well.
Wow, this movie, I was just looking at the cast list for Drop Dead Gorgeous. Amy Adams, Brittany Murphy, Kirstie Alley, Allison, like this is a packed movie.
I forgot it was Amy Adams again. I think it might be one of her first roles. And I also forgot about Brittany Murphy in it until we were watching it. God, I loved it though.
I am not a fan of Kirsten Dunst. I don't think she's a good actor, although I will give her, I think in Interview with a Vampire, she was great.
Yeah, I mean, she was amazing. She was also, what, 13 probably, right?
I think she was like 9.
Mm. She was great in that. Did you ever watch The Virgin Suicides?
She was 12. No, I didn't.
I enjoyed her in that, but that's also a controversial movie. I also enjoyed her in Melancholia, which is also a controversial movie, though. I really like Melancholia. It's definitely, you have to know what you're going into to watch it, but I think it's a great movie, personally.
Why is it controversial?
It's artsy, I guess.
Okay.
You know?
God forbid.
The opening like scene is shot sort of in slow motion artistically. And it's a good long few minutes of no dialogue. And I think like things like that turn people off right away. And I think it's Lars von Trier, too. And he's a little unusual. So,
wow, I'm impressed that you pulled that name out. I've never heard of that person.
I think he's done a lot of work with Bjork. And, you know, Bjork's my favorite. So I
love Bjork.
Latch on to that name. But should we move on?
Yes, let's do it.
Okay, so it is, let's see, chapter 21, Dragon Reborn. And away we go. The name of the chapter is A World of Dreams. The icon is a dream ring, and it is supposed to indicate, and I wrote down the pronunciation. I'm going to get this right. Tell Aran Riyadh. Okay. Tell Aran Riyadh.
Yeah.
Which is like the world of dreams and dot dot dot. We'll get into it.
If we wanted to piss off every single listener, we could just call it the telly.
The telly rod.
Yeah.
Okay, so this is going to be an Egwene chapter,
That's the symbol, by the way, that I think if I had to pick any symbol for the Wheel of Time to get a tattoo of, I think I would pick this one.
I think it's really pretty. I totally didn't read it as a ring.
What did you think it was?
I thought it was just like a swirling colors. Like, I thought it was going to signify some sort of Aes Sedai, black and white. You know what I mean?
Cause, oh, yeah.
You know what I mean? I
just because of the meow meow.
Yeah,
okay.
The yin-yang stuff. So Egwene is channeling her inner Cinderella, and she's doing all of the chores. She's wondering if there's ever been so many dishes to wash anywhere ever. And I thought, you need to work a shift at Starbucks, because you'd be like, get me back to the White Tower in a second.
Also, like, you were an innkeeper's daughter. I feel like you must have been washing dishes all the time.
Come on now. And do Aes Sedai really, like, focus that much on, like, eating? I feel like I never see scenes of the Aes Sedai eating. I've never seen scenes of the Aes Sedai eating in the White Tower.
Mm. In the White Tower, no.
Mm.
But I think Moraine ate with them at the inns, yeah, and stuff, you know, in the first book.
She's just trying to fit in with the lay people. New theory.
Theory is that Aes Sedai don't eat. Okay.
Just kidding. Don't get mad, Twitter. Don't get mad, everybody. She is, you know, doing all the chores, and she's saved by the bell, or saved luckily, because Varin has summoned for her, and you mustn't keep Varin waiting. So Varin, not surprisingly, has her chambers above the library, exactly where I would have expected it to be.
Yeah.
And Egwene's journey there to her chambers is told like it's an episode of Are You Afraid of the Dark? It's like, she's like sneaking through a dark chamber in the library. There's these like corridors. She's like scared, like frightenedly walking through. Nobody's around. But she eventually sees what she believes to be either an accepted or a novice in the distance, because she sees like a white flash. I would believe it's probably that lunatic Lanfear, but that's just my theory. Okay, so she finally arrives to Varin's room, and it's described just how I expect it to be. And I just have a quote. Books and papers and scrolls covered nearly every flat surface, with all sorts of odd things interspersed among the piles, and sometimes on top of them. Strange shapes of glass or metal, spheres and tubes interlinked, and circles held inside circles, stood among bones and skulls of every shape and description. What appeared to be a stuffed brown owl, not much bigger than Egwene's hand, stood on what seemed to be a bleached white lizard's skull. Candlesticks had been stuck about in haphazard fashion, giving good light here and shadows there, although seeming in danger of setting fire to papers in some places. The owl blinked at her and she jumped. I just loved this whole description, because I thought it was, like, extremely, extremely scene-setting for me. Like, I really felt like I was in there.
It's so funny. I think one of the early tweets that I made on our Cool Story Twitter was talking about how much, like, being a brown Aja is just sounds like such a dream life to me. Like, you get to be a super-powered superhero person who just gets to sit around and read all day.
It seems so cool. It's like
it seems awesome.
It's like she's a mad scientist, or like a kooky witch living in like a little, like, you know what I mean? She's like puddling around with potions and tinctures, and there's like a Bunsen burner going. She's like Madame Mim. Madame Mim, yes, could fit in here.
Yes.
So she hurries her into her chambers. She hurries Egwene in, and as she's standing there in front of her, she notices Varin's obsessing over a piece of paper that is the only surviving piece of a manuscript from ages ago, referencing Baal Zaman and Ishmael and who can slay the betrayer of hope. She explains this to her, and Egwene is like, yeah, that sucks, but why am I here?
Why am I here?
And Varin's like, oh, yeah, right. Sorry, you're here. She hands her these documents that describe all of the missing Tarungriel and the little they know about them, as well as the names of all the Black Aja and whatever they know about them. And she says these will be important, but what might be even more useful is what she's about to talk to her about. And so Varin has been chatting with Anaya, who has been testing Egwene, if we remember, to see if she's a dreamer. And Egwene is like, yeah, I know about that, but I keep failing all the tests. So what does this have to do with anything? And Varin explains that there's more to it than just foretelling and these sort of tests that Anaya has been doing with her. Anaya still believes that she may be a dreamer, the first one in over 400 years since Corianin Nadil?
Corianin Nadil.
Corianin Nadil. Okay.
That's how I say it. And she is, sometimes on Twitter, people will talk about, like, if you could have a just like a side book or like a little side novel about any character from like kind of like the Wheel of Time past or whatever that we don't really learn a whole ton about, she would be my number one pick.
Ooh, I mean, just from this alone, I'm interested, you know?
Yeah.
So she now goes into an explanation of Teleron Riad, or the World of Dreams, and Egwene gathers from this that it's similar to the Portal Stones and the other what-if worlds. But Varen says, yes, that's you're on track, but it's even harder to reach. It's a little bit like the World of Dreams is really only accessible to very, very few people.
Mm-hmm.
And she says, you have to remember that the World of Dreams, no matter what it's called, it's possible to be hurt in them. They are dangerous. And in all of the World of Dreams, like what ifs and possibilities, there are just a few constants. There's always a Dark One. There's always a Creator. And if the Dark One is defeated or released in any one of them, it happens in all of them. It's kind of like a little conundrum.
Yeah.
And that as a dreamer, if she is a dreamer, she would not only be able to access glimmers of these worlds through this, but she'd be able to actually enter it.
Mm-hmm.
And then Varen takes out a ring and says, Egwene, from the moment I laid eyes upon you, I knew you're the one. Will you make me the luckiest Aes Sedai? No, she says, here's a ring. She gives it to Egwene and says that it's a Tarangriel and it belonged to Coriannon. Is that her saying? Coriannon?
Yeah.
Yeah. And she said that Coriannon had said that this helped the transition to the World of Dreams easier. It says, the ring certainly looked like stone, but it felt harder than steel and heavier than lead. And the circle of it was twisted. If she ran a finger along one edge, it would go around twice, inside as well as out. It only had one edge. She moved her finger along the edge twice just to convince herself. I thought that was kind of cool. And then that kind of helped me understand the icon.
Yeah.
And she tells her to keep this ring hidden and remember that the dream world, you can be harmed, and that, you know, a wound that could be sustained in there cannot be healed as easily once she returns. And she has the scars to prove it. And she shows her a gnarly scar. And she promises, you know, Egwene promises to be careful. She scurries away. And then we get a really quick POV shift to Varen, who wonders if she should have given the notes Coriannon had with the ring, but says it's probably best that she didn't yet. And then she has these notes that she keeps with her. And then she wonders where her manuscript page ran off to. And that is the end of the chapter.
Why do you think Varen withheld the papers from Egwene?
I was wondering the same thing. The only, like, supposing I can do about it is that the dream world is a lot more dangerous. There's a lot more at risk than she wants Egwene to be aware of, maybe. And she really wants her to be a dreamer and enter the dream world, and she doesn't want her to get scared off by something. That's my guess.
Okay, great. So, chapter 22 is called The Price of the Ring. And it is not about the ring that Egwene just received, but a different ring.
Misleading.
So, so the sigil for this chapter is the Flame of Tarvalon, which means it's about Aes Sedai. And Egwene is walking away from Varen's chambers. It's still an Egwene point of view chapter. And almost immediately, she runs into Sheriam, who's like, hello, where have you been? You're holding everybody up. And asks Egwene what the papers are that she's holding. And Egwene kind of like clutches them tightly and is like, Varen just told me to study them. But inside, she's like, oh, fuck, I hope nobody asks to look at these because it's a list of all the Black Aja who ran away from the tower and all the things they stole. Which is kind of like a big neon arrow pointing right at her.
I mean, that's a big deal.
That's
kind of like the whole plan.
The whole plan. Sheriam thankfully is like, never mind, everybody's waiting. And Egwene is like, what are you talking about? And Sheriam tells her that you are to be tested tonight and raised to accepted. And Egwene is like, I need to wash my hair. My skirt's dirty. I'm a little tired. I've just been feeling kind of down. So if we could do this another time. And Sheriam's response is, the hour waits on no woman. And she says, the wheel weaves as the wheel wills, when the wheel wills. Ooh. And she tells her, like, besides, like, what would you have done to prepare? You already know that it's, like, basically you know that it sucks because your friend Nynaeve went through it already. She says that the Amyrlin saw no point in waiting, and as I've said before, if you give Swan an opportunity to make a fish analogy, she will make it, because she said, once you decide to gut a fish, there's no use waiting till it rots. You know what's fun, I just realized, is I feel like Robert Jordan has to, like, I never really thought about coming up with a bunch of, like, idioms specific to, the, like, different regions mm-hmm. and, like, nations in the world. Such a level of detail that I would never think to put into a book. Okay, so she says that Elaine has likely already made it through the arches by the time that they get down there, and Egwene is letting herself be led further and further underground toward the room where they're tested to be raised to accepted, and she's thinking that all that she really knows about Nynaeve having gone through it was that Nynaeve emerged kind of pissed off, upset, heartbroken. Mm. So she's like, great, don't know what this is about to be, but I know that it's going to emotionally devastate me for a little while.
Hooray.
Hooray. So they walk into the testing chamber that we've seen before. It's this great domed chamber. And immediately upon walking in, it's our best friend, Elaida, who is like, not took you long enough.
Calm down, Elaida.
So nasty. So nasty and so rude. So RJ writes a really beautiful description of the room that I was going to read, but we've seen it before, so I won't go into it. But again, it's the three silver arches with the ends touching where they join the ring. And next to each arch, do you say arch or arc?
I say arch.
I think I say arch when I'm referring to, like, an actual physical thing that I could touch. And I say arc when I talk about, like, math.
I say arc probably only, I never talk about math, because, but if I did, I think I say arc for, like, storyline arc, and then arch for everything else.
Well, that isn't that arc with a C?
It could be.
Because there's arc with an H, arc with a C, and arc with a K.
There is arc with a K.
And there's aardvark.
There is aardvark.
Okay. Sheriam basically tells Elaida to calm the fuck down and then turns to Egwene and says that she has three chances to refuse the test. She can refuse to take the test and enter the arches twice, but if she refuses a third time, she will be put out of the tower. And she says to Egwene, like, you have the right to say no at this point, but I kind of have the impression that the Amyrlin will not be pleased if you do that, so I am encouraging you not to.
Yeah, strongly suggesting.
Yes. And Elaida, in her just life's journey to be the biggest gaping asshole, is like, I don't think she should even have the chance. I don't care what potential she has. She should be put out of the tower.
You know, I was just starting to like Elaida, too. Now,
were you?
I just felt like she was secretly going to be a good guy that looked like a bad guy.
I mean, she could still be.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know.
Not in this moment.
I know. Now I'm thinking that all of her motives to keep Elaine safe and make her the first Aes Sedai that is
a queen
are actually for nefarious reasons, unfortunately.
Interesting. So Sheriam gives Elaida dagger eyes again and is like, will you? She basically turns into Skyler in Breaking Bad and is like, shut up. Egwene says that she won't object to taking the test, and Sheriam is like, good. And now I will tell you a little bit more, which is, once you begin the test, if you refuse at any point, you will be put out of the tower. Some women never come out of the arches, and when the Tarangriel was allowed to grow quiet, they just never returned. And so she's like, okay, you have one last chance. Do you want to do it or not? And Egwene decides to do it. So Sheriam tells her to ready herself, and Egwene remembers she has to do this naked, so she goes and undresses and kind of, like, carefully piles her clothes on top of her notes about the Black Aja, so she can be like, okay, hopefully I can see if anybody, like, touches this or whatever.
Ugh, so much anxiety. I was like, oh, someone's gonna snatch that ring.
Because she's worried anybody could rifle through it while she's taking the test. Mm-hmm. So before the test begins, Alana speaks up and says that there's some kind of resonance, an echo almost. And Sheriam is like, is there a problem? Because I am not sending a woman through the arches if you think there's a problem. And Alana replies, no, it's like having a bite me buzz around your head when you're trying to think, but it does not interfere. I would not have mentioned it, only it has never happened before that I've ever heard. And then she shakes her head and says, it's gone now. They begin the ceremony, and Sheriam intones, the first time is for what was. The way back will come but once, be steadfast. And Egwene steps through the arch, and RJ writes, the light swallowed her whole. She is suddenly in a small farmhouse, rocking a cradle. And in the room with her is Rand. And she has this awareness that Rand is her husband and that the baby in the cradle is her daughter, Joya. Which is, I think Joya, by the way, is a really cute name. The
so
way,
do
especially
I.
The way they spell it in the book.
I agree.
I think it's really cute. She hears this disembodied voice whispering. Let's see if I can do this. The way back. Nope, can't do it. The way back will come but once. Be steadfast.
I love that.
Rand mentions to Egwene that he's kind of been hearing some weird stories about a war kind of taking up most of the world, and people are fighting some folk called the Shocken or the Sanchin.
Or the Sandwich or the...
He says that the rumors about these people are that the Aes Sedai use them in battle, and they offer 1,000 gold marks to anyone who turns over an Aes Sedai for them. Scary. Rand suddenly kind of like grabs his head, and Egwene asks if he's having one of his headaches, which we learn he's been having these really intense headaches. And when he gets them, weird things start to happen, like a lightning bolt out of a clear sky, or like something will catch fire, or there'll be really strong winds all of a sudden. And Egwene is like, she's been kind of realizing that she might have some sort of like inner power because she's been training to be the wisdom, and she's been healing some folks beyond what should have been possible with the herbs and training that she's gotten. And so she's thinking, I have to help Rand. And as she starts to head toward him, she sees the silver arch outside of the house and hears, the way back will come but once, be steadfast. And she starts walking toward the arch, but is like in a lot of emotional turmoil because this was the life she had envisioned. And as she starts walking toward the silver arch, Rand falls to his knees and he starts screaming in pain, calling to Egwene for help. But she, like tears rolling down her cheeks, keeps marching toward the silver arches and steps into the light and emerges back into the testing chamber, sobbing. And they pour clear cold water over her, and Elida intones, you are washed clean of what sin you may have done and of those done against you. You are washed clean of what crime you may have committed and of those committed against you. You come to us washed clean and pure in heart and soul.
And because it's Elida, she probably was like, or whatever.
Or whatever, I guess. I love that. I love the idea of her ending it with, or whatever.
Like under her breath.
Yeah. Sheriam begins guiding Egwene to the second arch, and Egwene is upset and you know, kind of holding back tears. And she says to Sheriam that nothing could be worth what she just did. And Sheriam says that there is price to becoming Aes Sedai. And she asks Sheriam if it was real. And Sheriam says, every woman asks that, but no one knows. And she thinks that some of the women who don't come back choose to remain and live out the rest of their lives there. And she has no sympathy for those women because they were weak and not strong enough to come back.
Do we ever find out what actually for real happens to women who don't pass this test?
To women who don't pass the test?
Like who don't come out of the test.
Oh, who I don't mean. Come out of the arches?
Is ever
I think we learn enough to make a very educated guess in the series. Yeah. Egwene steps through as Sheriam says, this is the second time is for what is. The way back will come but once, be steadfast. And this time Egwene is in the ruins of a great palace, and she looks around and recognizes it as the royal palace of Andor. And it kind of makes her want to scream in terror that the great palace of Andor is basically in ruins, and she can see like patrols of Trollocs and Dark Friends everywhere, and just ruin and devastation every way she looks. And she starts to kind of like creep her way through the palace, and she like comes across the body of a dead Aes Sedai, but she doesn't let it give her pause because she's like, I can't do anything for the dead. And so RJ writes, forcing her way through a narrow gap where part of the ceiling had fallen, she found herself in a room half buried under what had stood above it. Rand lay with a heavy beam pinning him across the waist, his legs hidden beneath the stone blocks that filled half the room. Dust and sweat coated his face. He opened his eyes when she came near him. And he's like, oh, thank God, Egwene, you're here. You have to help me. And she kind of like goes and kneels by him. And she's like, I could lift the beam pinning you. But if I do, the rest of the room will cave down upon us. And I can't like hold up an entire building. And Rand says that he could do it himself, but he can't trust himself to channel, that essentially he's been able to hold the madness at bay. But if he lets go and channels, then the madness will have him. And so he's asking Egwene for help, and she's like, what do you want me to do? And he kind of gestures toward a dagger that's just out of reach and tells her that she has to kill him, that you have to stab me in the heart and kill me.
Could you imagine?
No. Ugh. And she's like, why would you ask me to do that? And he says, because they can turn me. If they take me, the Dreadlords can turn me to the shadow. And Egwene, at this point, sees the silver arch and starts heading toward it. She ignores Rand's calls for her to kill him and put him out of his misery and not let him be turned to the shadow. And as she steps through the silver archway, she hears him scream, help me, Egwene. And RJ writes that the light burned her to ash. That's got to be a pretty haunting thing to hear.
Yeah. Yikes.
For the rest of your life. So she steps into the domed chamber, kind of like muttering to her to herself. Cold water pours over her again. And this time, Elida says, you are washed clean of false pride. You are washed clean of false ambition. You come to us washed clean in heart and soul. Or whatever.
Or whatever. I mean, I'm just, I have to say it because I'll say it. I'm just like, fine.
Oh, me. I said nothing.
Sheriam guides Egwene toward the third arch. And as they're heading toward it, Egwene says, he said they could turn him to the shadow. He said Myrdral and Dreadlords could force him. And Sheriam kind of like stumbles and is like, don't talk about that. She also says it's custom to not speak of what happens in the arches. And Egwene pushes her, though, and is like, is that possible? And Sheriam says that, yes, it's possible. But she hopes, she thinks and she hopes it's not something that's been done since the Trolloc Wars. She says it takes 13 Dreadlords, dark friends who can channel, weaving flows through 13 Myrdral, and then they can be turned to the shadow. But she says it's not very easily done because there are no Dreadlords today. And Egwene is like, except for those 13 black Aja who just left the tower with Leandrin.
Coincidence.
And Sheriam's like, well, just, I mean, don't worry about that. Okay. So they approach the final arch. And Sheriam says, the third time is for what will be. The way back will come but once. Be steadfast. So Egwene steps through the arch and is kind of thinking to herself about Leandrin and the 12 others, these 13 dark friends who can channel, and thinks light help us all. And as she steps through the light, RJ writes, there was nothing but the light and the pain. So this time, Egwene is standing in front of a like a big, tall stand mirror, and she's sort of stunned to see that she has sort of the ageless look of an Aes Sedai on her face, but even more shocked to see the seven-striped stole of the Amyrlin seat around her shoulders, which, by the way, try saying seven-striped stole a lot. It's very challenging. She hears the voice saying the way back, but then it kind of like buzzes out and says 13. Probably not like a robot, but
I like that.
The voice I picked. Thank 13. You. She kind of has like a wave of dizziness and thinks something is wrong. There's like this sense of wrongness about something. But she kind of like looks at the woman next to her, who she recognizes as another Aes Sedai, and she comments how she has like Sheriam's high cheekbones, and she has dark hair with dark brown eyes, but she's wearing the Keeper's stole, and Egwene knows that her name is Beldine. At least that's how I'm going to say it.
I like that name.
I do too. Egwene notes that Beldine has a green shawl, and that the Keepers of the Chronicles are always raised from the same Aja that the Aes Sedai, or that the Amyrlin was, so she... Egwene knows herself to have been Green Aja before she was raised to the Amyrlin seat. She hears the kind of like the way back, but it's like buzzing and interrupted, and she hears 13 dark friends. So she looks at Beldine and says, we mustn't keep them waiting, and they start heading out of the chamber. And she notices that Beldine is kind of calm on the surface, but she seems terrified and sort of frozen. They're walking. Again, she hears like the way back. Again, it's buzzy, interrupted, and she hears 13 of the Black Aja. And they walk into this large circular room that's 30 paces high with this raised platform all around the perimeter and kind of the flame of Tarvalon inlaid in the floor. I really look forward to a lot of the set elements of this show.
Yeah.
Or rather, of the show that's coming. Like, I can't wait to see like how detailed they make things like that. And just the world building through the visual stuff is going to be pretty exciting to see.
I know, I'm really pumped.
Beldine wraps her staff on the floor and intones, "She comes, the Watcher of the Seals, the Flame of Tarvalon, the Amyrlin Seat, she comes." All the Aes Sedai along the perimeter of the room stand up, and Egwene realizes that she's in the Hall of the Tower. And she also again hears the way back, but this time it's kind of like skipping like a record, like that scene from Easy A where she keeps opening the card, pocket full of sunshine. I got a pocket. But it kind of ends with the Black Aja waits. Egwene goes and sits in the Amyrlin's throne, and immediately Elida stands up and is like, "Bring him in." And in walks Rand in chains, surrounded by guards. And Elida proclaims that this man has declared himself to be the Dragon Reborn, and that according to Tower law, he must be gentled. And Egwene realizes essentially that the fate of the world hangs in the balance, because if Rand is gentled, then the world, he can't save the world from the Dark One. Mm-hmm. So she refuses to pass the order, and Elida immediately shouts that she's betrayed the Aes Sedai, she's betrayed herself, and she screams, "Take her." And just then, Beldine takes the Keeper's staff and whacks Egwene in the head and knocks her unconscious. Betrayal.
Terrible.
Okay, so Egwene starts to regain consciousness, and she's like hurting, and she realizes she's like naked on a cold slab, and she's hearing voices around her, and including like a voice that's described like a snake on dead leaves, the raspy voice of a mere drawl. And she like kind of peeks open. You know what's really funny, Matt, when you're telling the story to me, do you do stuff with your hands? Like,
oh yeah.
Okay. I literally just like put my hand to my eye and like kind of like held open my eye just a little bit as I was telling you the story about how she like peeps open her eyes.
I always do.
And
that.
Sees like 13 sisters and 13 mere drawl around her. So she immediately is like, "Oh my God, I'm about to be turned to the Dark One." She screams in pure terror. And RJ writes, "Even in the midst of fear that tried to split her bones, she reached out for the true source. Flames burst out of the skin of the mere drawl, and then Egwene rips chunks of stones out of the walls around her and sends them flying into the Aes Sedai, the wind whirling like a whirlwind. And so all of the mere drawl are dead, all of her captors are dead or unconscious, which one person overwhelming 13 mere drawl and 13 Aes Sedai is pretty impressive.
I mean, I was like, damn, badass.
Super badass. So she makes her way out of the rooms, and she immediately comes face to face with another Aes Sedai who is like about to walk in the room. And rather than channeling, Egwene just cold cocks her right in the face and knocks her ass out and makes it to a nearby dressing room and finds some clothes. And there she comes upon Beldine, and Beldine is there crying, saying that she was forced to betray her, that three nights prior they had come to her and stilled her and told her that she could only have her ability to channel given back by the Dark One. And she says that they tortured her and that Elida was essentially leading this group of Black Aja. Mm. And so Egwene says, "So Elida is Black Aja." And then says she has to go save Rand. Beldine asks, like, "Well, what could you do?" And Egwene says, "More than you can imagine," and tells her that she has never held the Oath Rod. And in Archie's writing, he kind of comments how Egwene knows that to be true, but also it's one of the requirements to becoming Aes Sedai. So how could she have become Aes Sedai, let alone the Amyrlin, without having ever held the Oath Rod? But she knows it to be true. Mm. She races to find Rand and makes her way to an overlook above the Traitor's Court where Rand is facing judgment from the Aes Sedai. And as she's about to try to rescue him, she hears, "The way back will come but once, be steadfast." And the archway is behind her, but it's kind of like flickering and fading to transparency and then appearing again. And she's, again, like really called to save Rand, but also called by, you know, returning to the archway. And she hears panicked voices kind of coming from the doorway as well, saying things like, can't hold it much longer. If she doesn't come out now, somebody else shouting, hold, burn you, or I'll gut you all like sturgeons. Mm-hmm. And another saying, it's going wild, mother, we can't. And then they all kind of like fade out, drone to silence. And again, she hears the way back will come but once, and the doorway is there. And with a scream of rage, of loss, RJ writes, Egwene threw herself at the arch as it shimmered like a heat haze. She almost wished she would miss and plunge to her death. Light plucked her apart fiber by fiber, sliced the fibers to hairs, split the hairs to wisps of nothing, all drifted apart on the light forever. And that is the end of chapter 22, The Price of the Ring. Wasn't that such a good chapter?
That really was. Yeah, I was looking forward to it. As soon as I realized it was going to be her going through the arches, I was like, ooh, this was one of my favorites with Nynaeve.
I know. Okay, so I want to talk to you about it. So what are your thoughts on kind of like the three worlds? First, okay, so, you know, they say the first is for what was, the second is for what is, and the third is for what will be. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, she has these kind of like three different worlds. So I'm just interested to hear your interpretation of that.
The first thing that struck me about all three of them was that in all three of them, it centered around Rand.
Yes.
And that in all three of them, no matter what the circumstances were, Rand was still the dragon.
Yes.
And that was different than like with Nynaeve, where she had just three different experiences. You know what I mean? That didn't center around, like, Lan in all of them, for instance.
True, yeah.
So this was different because it was all about, like, how Egwene fits into, like, I guess the pattern, it felt like to me. And I thought it was interesting that, yeah, like, no matter what, Rand was always the dragon. Mm-hmm. So, like, the one that was would have been, like, the world that Egwene could have had if Rand never found out that he was the dragon.
Yeah, like maybe if Moraine never came to the Two Rivers or something like that.
Yeah, so like neither of them would ever have been aware that they have access to the One Power, but this is sort of what their life would have looked like. And look, no matter what, it ends that way. And then same thing for like what is, you know, but I guess that's her biggest fear is that she can't save Rand. So I expect that that's why it's being shown to her over and over.
Yeah. What are your thoughts on, so I'm interested to hear a couple of things. I guess one we can talk more about in the next episode when we get to the next chapter, because I'm pretty sure the next chapter is her emerging from the archway.
Yeah.
So I have a question about that. But what do you make, like, what's your guess? Is this world real? Or what do you think is happening? Is it a sliding doors moment?
I think it accesses, like, your worst fears. So I don't think it's actually real.
Okay.
Not to say that that's not the way it could have happened, but I think it just accesses like your absolute worst fears of what could be and then just shows them to you.
Did you ever watch the episode of Charmed with, well, not just the episode, there were like six of them with the demon of fear?
Probably, but it's been so long.
They had this actor, I want to look up his name. Listen, if you're a listener, go out there and just Google Charmed Demon of Fear. I think his name might be Barbas was his name.
Okay.
Just go watch a YouTube video of the actor who plays Barbas. He makes some choices, and I disagree with most of them. It's kind of like somebody who's like, you know, swinging for the fences and misses 90% of the time.
I do remember this guy. I'm looking him up right now. Very like trying to be Goblin King Labyrinth.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah. Yeah. He thought he was doing like high acting, like Lord of the Rings fantasy. And it was like, girl, you're on the CW.
Or the WB at the time.
Or the WB at the time. Why did I bring that up? Greatest Fears. Yeah. That's why.
Yeah.
Yeah. So you think it brings it kind of taps into their fears and creates a world that they have to deal with somehow?
I think so. I think that they are, let me rephrase it. I think they are real worlds, but I think it just accesses the worlds that represent their worst fears. Does that make sense?
Yes.
They are possible what ifs, like just like the portal stones, but they're
just like sliding doors.
Yeah. Like worst case scenarios.
Okay. Interesting.
Do you,
what was your favorite part of these two chapters?
That. You beat me to the punch. I would say, yeah, Egwene getting the ring from Varin.
That's a really great moment. Yeah.
I really liked that because it's like opening up a whole new world. Don't you dare close your eyes. And it's just exciting because it's fleshing out more parts of the story that have been sort of unknowns for now.
Yeah, And I think more than any moment in the books so far, that moment where you get the description of Varen's room feels like that moment in like a video game where you like get to the all-powerful wizard's chamber and like you have to ask your like three questions kind of thing, mm-hmm. you know?
Yes.
And there's like a dragon lurking in the background and all kinds of beakers.
Have you ever played Chrono Trigger, right?
I've never played Chrono Trigger, no.
It's very much like when you get to Lucca's house.
I was more going to say it reminds me of the wizard Erasmus in the Quest for Glory computer game series.
I never played it.
Matt, I'm really surprised. I bet your brother has played it.
He probably has. He was way more into computer games than I was. They were harder for me to control with like the little up, down, left, right buttons on the keyboard.
My favorite part, thank you for asking, was I just love the ceremony. Like, I think all of the elements of Egwene's sort of experience going through the archways is fascinating. But I just love the ceremony of it. Like, they could have just had her walk through the three archways and that could have been the entire thing. But the whole, like, pouring the cold water, like, you are washed clean of this, of false... Like, it's so clearly, like, baptismal in mm-hmm. reference, but it's just, like... Adding in those sorts of elements of like ceremony or whatever just makes it feel so much more significant and it makes it feel so much more real. So I'm going to say that's kind of like my favorite element of these two chapters.
I agree. I think the descriptions of these ceremonies so far are so intimate and like,
yes,
they feel so heavily weighted, you know, it feels like appropriate.
Yeah, yes, I agree. It feels a very significant moment where there's just kind of a lot of, like, weight in the air.
Yeah.
Well, great.
So, did you know that for $0 a month, you can help support our podcast simply by rating and reviewing it on whatever platform you're currently using to listen to this episode? Did you know?
I didn't know that, but that's good to know. Also, did you know that most people try a podcast because a friend recommends it? So if you're enjoying our show, please tell a friend.
And our social media is CoolStoryPod on Instagram and CoolStoryPod1 on Twitter. You can email us at CoolStoryPod@gmail.com. We love getting emails, as we always say. Please keep them coming.
And thank you so much for listening to Cool Story.
See you next week.
Bye.
Bye.